Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Today is Earth Day, and to celebrate, we will look at three different angles, starting with the endangered creature that lurks in Ohio's streams, the eastern hellbender, or as some people call it, the snot otter or the lasagna lizard, is a key indicator of the health of a river or stream. These fantastic beasts may not be the most attractive thing to look at, but they are gentle giants. Hellbenders are large, fully aquatic salamanders, meaning that they spend their lives in the water. They need cool, clean water to survive and thrive. Joining us now is Greg Lips, the Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Coordinator at Ohio State and a conservation biologist at the Columbus Zoo. Welcome to All Sides.
Well, thank you very much.
So can you start by telling us what an eastern hellbender is? Try to describe what it looks like.
Sure. So it's an amphibian. It's a salamander. It's the largest salamander in Ohio. They can get over 2 foot long. They're kind of laterally compressed, perfect for living underneath big rocks, usually a brown coloration. And because they breathe through their skin, they have these lots of folds on the side of their skin. So they're very wrinkly, very reduced eyes. You're living underneath a big rock. You don't really use sight all that much. Very prehistoric looking. A laterally compressed tail that allows them to swim when they need to, but most of the time they're crawling along the bottom.
Now, I said that they might not be the most attractive thing to look at, but did that hurt your feelings?
just a bit. But, you know, it's a lot of people look at them and say they're so ugly, they're cute. They're very, very unique looking creature, that's for sure.
Now, where can you find a hellbender in the world? Are they only in Ohio?
No, they're not just in Ohio, but they are limited to the Mississippi drainage with one small exception. So in Ohio, they're only going to be in our southern two-thirds of the state, the streams that are flowing towards the Ohio River, not the Lake Erie drainage. Historically, they were found throughout Ohio. They were found in all of our major rivers. But today, they're very reduced, and most of them occur in eastern Ohio towards the Pennsylvania-West Virginia border.
Okay, so we wouldn't see one in a stream around here?
It's possible. It every once in a while, they do show up in places that you don't expect them. And, of course, we're trying to reestablish them. So hopefully someday you will see them here around this area.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Okay. So they're an important part of Ohio's streams and rivers. Why? I mentioned in the introduction that they are an indicator of the stream or river's health. Explain that.
Well, we use a lot of different organisms to look at how a stream is doing. So take, for example, the macroinvertebrates, the little bugs that live in the water. Those are really good indicator species that we use. But if you were to poison a river, something terrible was to happen, and then that poison was to leave, those macroinvertebrates will come back in very quickly because they can fly back in. A hellbender is going to take generations, many, many years before they ever come back. So by having hellbenders in a stream, it tells you not just that the water quality is good now, it tells you that water quality has been good for a very long time. It's been consistently good, which is, you know, makes them one of the better water quality indicators.
So the fact that we don't have them around here, does that mean that our water quality is not that great?
Well, our water quality is definitely improving. We've made huge strides in central Ohio in water quality, but we do still have some issues. And what we see with hellbenders is one of the best predictors of the status of their population is the amount of forest that is around our streams. And we don't have a lot of forest around our streams. We've cleared a lot of that. We have agriculture that goes up to the stream. So we still have some work to do. This results in a lot of increased sedimentation, siltation, washing into the waterways. And we also, have a lot of dams still in our waterways. And dams are another problem. They kind of turn the rivers into lakes. And they don't live in lakes. They live in rivers.
Okay. Now, they're salamanders, but they live fully in the water, right? So they don't need air to breathe?
Yeah. So I kind of think of these as like the Peter Pan of the salamander world. They never really want to grow up. Mm-hmm. So a lot of salamanders lay eggs in the water. The eggs hatch out into larvae, and then the larvae go through a metamorphosis where they come back onto land, much like a frog tadpole. With the hellbender, they do have a larval stage, and the larval stage lasts about a year and a half. And during that time, they have external gills. But then about a year and a half old, they go through this partial metamorphosis where they lose those external gills, but they never leave the water. And they do need oxygen, and they do have lungs, but most of that oxygen they're taking in through through their body, through the skin.
Now,
I called them, some people call them snot otters or lasagna lizards. Do you call them that?
No, I don't. But there is a long list of funny names that people have come up with them. I've heard old lasagna sides is another one. Devil dog is another. There's a lot of colorful names for them.
Is that because of their look? Do they look like lasagna? Is that?
Yes, because yeah. of the wrinkles on the side of their skin. Very much they look like lasagna. Yep.
Okay. So tell me how you got involved in basically caring about the future of the Eastern Hellbender.
Boy, I'll tell you, I have had an interest in this species since I was a little kid. In fact, I remember writing an article for the Amphibian News Quarterly, you know, 40 plus years ago, probably at this point, about hellbenders. And so when the Salamanders of Ohio book came out in 1989, I was only 14 years old, but I was fascinated with the Hellbender chapter. And it was that book, one of the editors was Ralph Fingston, and I had the opportunity to meet Ralph and immediately started pestering him about going back and redoing his survey that he had done in the mid-80s. So we eventually did that. From 2006 to 2010, Ralph and I traveled the state looking at all of his previous sites where he had found hellbenders and looking for new ones and just trying to reassess how the population was doing. And that really was the kind of the survey that kicked it all off, because what we saw was big declines. Most of the sites we saw no signs of any recruitment, just old animals, kind of like everything was a nursing home. There was no youngsters. And it was very disappointing. 82% relative abundance decline is what we calculated when we finished that survey in 2010. And much to the credit of the Ohio Division of Wildlife, their response was, okay, well, let's do something about it. What are we going to do? And that hatched the conservation plan. It hatched the Ohio Hellbender Partnership, where we brought everybody together and started working on, you know, how do we recover the Eastern Hellbender?
Are they endangered?
They are state listed as endangered, and they just were proposed for federal listing as endangered too, which should take effect in January.
Oh, okay. So their population did they start to decline in the 80s or after the survey you said that Ralph did?
Well, that was the first baseline we have. But yeah. Just looking at what we've done in the state of Ohio and looking at old records, I'm sure the decline happened a lot earlier than that. In fact, the Ohio River used to be one of the premier spots to find hellbenders. And there's old accounts from professors in West Virginia coming to the Ohio River and catching lots of hellbenders. But we turned that into a series of lakes, so basically eliminated. And we've done that to a lot of areas. But with Ralph's work in the 80s, we had very good baseline data to show, yes, there's been this big decline.
How do you find them?
Well, back then, the main way, and still not an uncommon way, is to get into the water and find the largest rocks you can find and lift them, usually with several people using things like log PVs to help get some leverage. They live under these giant stable rocks. We don't do that as much anymore, mainly because what we found is hellbenders like those big rocks because they don't move. Mm. And so when you start moving those rocks, the hellbenders don't use them as much, or you don't get them back down the way they were before. And they're kind of limited habitat. What we've learned now is that we can actually snorkel pretty well and look under the rocks with dive lights and just look back in the cavities, and we can actually see the hellbenders. And we've gotten pretty good at doing this. And we've also started deploying hellbender huts. So these are, think of a bluebird box, but instead of for bluebirds, this is for hellbenders. It's a big concrete structure that goes in the water to mimic a rock with a cavity under it. And these have been really helpful because there's a locking lid on them. We can get in there and we can see the hellbender and see what's going on.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And for Earth Day, we're talking about saving the endangered Eastern Hellbender with Greg Lips, an amphibian and reptile conservation coordinator at Ohio State and a conservation biologist at the Columbus Zoo. So you work at both Ohio State and the Columbus Zoo?
Correct.
Tell me like what you do at each of those places.
Well, the Ohio State University position is funded by the Ohio Division of Wildlife, so I do a lot of amphibian and reptile conservation work for them. The Columbus Zoo is launching into some new things, or I should say strengthening some of the things they've been doing in the past. And one of those is this Ohio Center for Wildlife Conservation. And there's a real focus at the Columbus Zoo to do more even more than they already are for local wildlife. Mm-hmm. And so that's my position there, is to focus on what we can do for our local wildlife here in Ohio. And we actually do have a building, the Ohio Center for Wildlife Conservation, that will be opening here as part of the North America Trek exhibit opening the end of May. And I couldn't be more pleased to see the local institution having this focus on our local wildlife, hellbenders and many other species.
So not just giraffes and elephants. We're now gonna what you can find actually here in Ohio.
Exactly. They're still doing great work with gorillas and manatees, but mm-hmm. we're also saying, what can we do for hellbenders, local pollinators, freshwater mussels?
So I've seen a hellbender at the zoo, right? I swear I have.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So, but they're going to move to a different exhibit, maybe the North America part. Is that?
There probably will still be an exhibit, but what you're going to get to see at the Ohio Center for Wildlife Conservation building is you're going to get to see a behind-the-scenes look at all the work that's going on that's normally tucked away somewhere where nobody gets to see it. So there'll be biosecure rooms where we are rearing animals for release into the wild, and we take a lot of precautions to make sure these animals are not picking up any kind of weird disease or anything like that. The keepers go in there and scrub up before they go in. And so you'll get to see plains garter snakes that are being reared to be released back out into the wild. You'll get to see hellbenders that are being reared for release back into the wild. And we've released over 2,000 hellbenders now into Ohio waterways, and over half of those have come from the Columbus Zoo.
Okay. So the idea is you're trying to find, you're raising them in captivity and then trying to release them into rivers and streams that you have tested and deemed clean enough for them.
Yeah. So what we notice is we're not getting that recruitment. We're not seeing babies in most of these areas. We're not seeing young ones. And interestingly, though, we still find the adults, and we still find the adults laying eggs. So we can collect those eggs, and where most of those or none of those would survive in the wild, mm-hmm. we can get very high survivorship at the zoo. And so we can really bolster those numbers. And recent research has shown that what's happening in a lot of these areas is that the males are protecting these nests. But the males, if they sense that it's not worth their time, the conditions aren't right, they'll eat the eggs, and they'll eat all of the eggs. And that's a strategy that's works for a long-lived animal. Don't waste your energy on taking care of something that's not going to survive. Do it again next year. But it obviously isn't adapted well if conditions never improve. And this is, again, tied to the amount of forest that is along the streams, the riparian forest.
Okay, so tell us why the average person should care about the future of the hellbender.
Boy, I may be the wrong person to answer that question, because it never occurs to me that these animals need to have an excuse to survive.
Yeah,
I think that they are just an incredible animal that's been around for so many millions of years. We don't know everything that they're doing in the environment. We don't know every role that they play. We know that they're eating crayfish and other things under the rocks. And we know that, you know, the larvae and the small animals get preyed upon by their animals. So they're part of that full food web that's so important in the ecosystem. But, you know, just overall, when you start breaking apart the parts of the ecosystem, mm-hmm. you're really threatening the whole ecosystem collapsing. And the ecosystem is what allows us to breathe and eat and drink water and have all these great services. So,
are you teaching the next generation of hellbender lovers at Ohio State too?
I hope I am. we are launching into another 3-year survey to go back and reassess. We're really excited to go out and look and see how many of these animals that we've released can we find. 2 years ago, we had what was one of the greatest days was when we found one of our animals that I collected as a little egg in 2013. And in 2016, we released it. It was a little 3-year-old animal, and we found it as an adult in one of our hellbender huts guarding a nest of eggs.
How did you know it was still the same one?
So we put a little microchip inside of each one of them, just like the microchip you put in your dog or cat.
Okay.
In fact, it's the same brand, and you can scan these animals, and they pop up with a barcode, a number, and it told us that's one of our animals. And that was just one of the most rewarding moments of my career, and I'm hoping we're going to have many more of those.
Are you the person actually in the river snorkeling? Do you do that?
I do, and I hope to continue to do that, but I am also hiring and training other people to do it. Yes.
Okay. And I also read that you your conservation efforts started a while ago in Japan. You learned about the Japanese salamander. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the family Cryptobranchidae, which is the family that has the giant salamanders, there's only three living species. There's the Eastern Hellbender, which actually is the smallest of the three. Then there's the Japanese and the Chinese giant salamanders. These are truly ginormous animals. I was lucky enough in 2010 to get to go to Japan, visit with their researchers. A few of us went over there. And the Japanese giant salamander is very much like our bald eagle. It's kind of a national symbol. You can buy trinkets and T-shirts, and people love it. So it's received a lot of attention for a long time. And that was really where we saw the idea of a hellbender hut for the first time. Mm. There it was called the Hanzaki hut, Hanzaki being the local name. And giant salamanders use burrows in the side of the stream, not rocks. So it was a little bit different, but just that idea. Also how to collect eggs. They had come up with these grappling hooks for pulling eggs out of. There was a lot of things we learned from our Japanese brethren, and we keep in touch. We just visited; they visited this year at our local hellbender our hellbender symposium.
Now, the one that you raised from 2013, and then you released in 2016, and then you saw it again. Where was that? What stream? Or
yeah. So we don't actually talk about the individual streams just to relieve any pressure. That there's people who want to go out and catch these, maybe for fun, maybe for photo, maybe also unfortunately for poaching. So we just kind of keep it all general.
Oh, okay.
I will tell you, it's kind of a fun story. That animal, that egg, originally went to the Toledo Zoo where it was hatched, and then because all the zoos worked together, that animal was transferred to the Columbus Zoo and where it was reared and then released. And so I love that we have this great partnership, and that animal kind of exemplifies that partnership.
That animal has been all over Ohio.
It has.
All right. Well, is there anything else you want to just add about the next steps for the Eastern Hellbender for you?
Well, I think, you know, I always walk a fine line of I think what we're doing is really important, and I want people to support it and be excited about it. But I also want people to understand that, you know, the decisions that we make as Ohioans about our land use is really what's going to determine how these animals do and how successful we are. And I've been very, hopeful with things like H2 Ohio and the H2 Ohio Rivers program, that there has been this focus on water quality in our aquatic communities. And I think that's fantastic. And the Columbus Zoo and Ohio State are ready to do what we can to keep that going.
And I look forward to seeing this new exhibit. It's so at the Columbus Zoo at the end of May is when it opens?
Correct. Yes.
All right. That was Gregory Lips, the amphibian and reptile conservation coordinator at Ohio State and a conservation biologist at the Columbus Zoo. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk about where the bison roam in central Ohio. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Today is Earth Day, and we're talking about some interesting ways to think about celebrating the Earth right here in Ohio. Some time ago, hundreds of thousands of bison roamed Ohio, grazing the plains. But they were nearly hunted to extinction. In fact, wild bison have not roamed in Ohio since the early 1800s. However, a little over 10 years ago, a herd of bison were relocated to Battelle-Darby Creek Metro Park. The goal of this reintroduction program is to help restore the park's native prairie ecosystem. Joining us to talk about the bison is Jeff Hamilton, park manager at Battelle-Darby Creek. Welcome to All Sides.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how do the bison help restore the park's native prairie ecosystem?
So, you know, it's really interesting. People look at the bison and, you know, they think that it's just something really neat to see and they get really excited about it. But, you know, for us, the bison are actually, it's almost like a learning tool. I mean, a lot of the land management practices that we use today kind of mimic what the bison were already naturally doing when there was, you know, hundreds of thousands of them on the landscape.
So do we want prairie grasses? Do we want flowers? What are the bison helping you with, like, the lawn mowing?
Yeah. So one of the things they do is what we refer to as, we call it succession mowing. So we don't want everything to be the same size. We like the habitat to be diverse. And those bison help the habitat to be diverse because they're not always eating the same thing. It's just like us. Like, you don't want to eat, well, maybe pizza every night. You know, sometimes you like to mix it up a little bit. And the bison do too. Now, theirs is more for nutritional value. So they're going to move from area to area, picking the plants that have the best nutrition at the time. And that changes throughout the year. So that creates like this mosaic of kind of different habitats and diversity in the plant structure that we have there. And essentially that does what we want to do. You know, instead of us having to mow certain areas to control different growth and allow new plants to spring up, the bison through their grazing kind of do the same thing. And in other ways, they help as far as, you know, one of the things that we do to help restore our prairies is we do prescribed burns. And they do a lot of the same things, helping with just, you know, healthy soils and plant diversity. But with the bison, you know, they kind of keep fuel levels down, and that grazing that they do almost creates natural fire breaks. So now in areas of the park we don't have bison, where we need to do those prescribed burns, we have to step in and kind of do some of those things and mow fire breaks and make sure that, you know, when we do prescribed burns, an area doesn't have too much fuel, because too much fire is definitely a bad thing. And so again, it's just really like mimicking what they do. So,
and how many bison do you have?
Currently we have 10. We had 13 up until a couple weeks ago, but we do kind of manage our herd for a couple different reasons. One, we try to keep one bull, just that way. If you get too many bulls in there, then they kind of want to, you know, fight to see who's the toughest guy on the block. And we would rather not have that happen there. So we do try to keep just one bull. And so we had some calves that were getting to the age where they were starting to get a little feisty. So we took those bull calves back to the wild who we partner with for our bison program.
Have you been with it from the beginning, the bison program?
I have not. I've been with the parks for 20 years now, and I've only been at Battelle Darby Creek for the past five. But I grew up in that area, and getting to Darby was like always my plan, you know? So I haven't been there since the beginning of the bison, but, you know, everybody in the park loves the bison. All the staff loves the bison. And so I've followed it along from the beginning.
Where did the idea in the beginning come from, where they're like, we have all this prairie, why not put bison on them? Where did that idea come from?
So I think part of the idea behind that is, you know, obviously, you know, a big focus of Metro Parks is obviously land management and creating areas where people can go and enjoy the outside. But it's also to educate people on those conservation kind of key principles and the importance of them. And I think that's where the bison step in. The nice thing about bison is, yeah, it's a great, big, iconic animal. People love to see it. But because of its history on the landscape, it allows us to go into so many different areas for education conversation. It's kind of like that catalyst. So our naturalist staff, they can start talking about bison. And because of how, you know, their influence on the park and their influence on ecosystems, like, they can basically navigate that conversation into any other topic they really want to, that comes back to whether it's, you know, it could be our land management practices, it could be human interactions and how that kind of goes along with wildlife. And so they're just great at kind of weaving that story, you know, into whatever we may be talking about related to the bison.
So I mentioned that hundreds of thousands of bison used to roam Ohio. But would, so if it was like the 1600s or 1700s, would we just, if, and we were walking in what is now Battelle Darby Creek, would we see bison everywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of time when people think about bison, they think of the American West, you know, and that's true. I mean, there was tons of bison out there. But what people don't realize is that those bison, that herd of bison, I guess, it extended all the way through Ohio and even parts of Pennsylvania. So where Battelle Darby Creek is, it's actually kind of on the corner of what we call the Darby Plains. So the restored prairie grass that you would see out there is actually very similar, if not exactly the same, as what you would have saw hundreds of years ago when there were thousands of bison out there. So yeah, Battelle Darby Creek, if you could go back in time and look at that area, you would see those bison on the landscape there.
Were they hunted for meat back in the day? Is that why they were hunted almost to extinction?
Yeah. So the hunting for extinction, I wouldn't necessarily use the term hunting. I mean, market hunting is usually what we refer to when what happened with the bison. And that was more of a commodification of a resource. So, yeah, I mean, bison were, the meat was used sometimes, but that hunting, market hunting through extinction was really just, there was so, it was supply and demand. So there were so many products back east for, or a demand for products, there's pelts basically. And as people moved west, they just saw this opportunity to make money off of those items. And the supply was so big, I'm sorry, the demand was so big that they just
dwindled the supply.
Dwindled the supply down.
Yeah. And I feel compelled when talking about bison. I always feel compelled to, you know, you want to say, give me a home where the buffalo roam, right? Yeah. So how often do people get mixed up and think they're buffalo?
So personally, you know, for me, it's tomato, tomato. I mean, American buffalo, bison. I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I will say some of our staff, though, take it kind of personal when people miscall them a buffalo. But, you know, realistically, I think what it is when Europeans first came over here and saw the bison, their frame of reference was a buffalo, you know, what you find in Asia or Africa. And so they look very similar, and the name just kind of stuck. So, like, when people say buffalo, like, I know what you're talking about. but, yeah, and the correct term is bison.
Okay. So you do a lot of work with the wilds, which is an extension of the Columbus Zoo on
correct.
Conservation efforts for the bison. What role does the zoo and the wilds have in all this?
Well, for one, I keep the wilds on speed dial because they have a much bigger herd than us. So anytime we're seeing something weird or we're like, you know, I don't know really how this is going to work or how they're going to react to this, always kind of talk to them first. But the great thing is it allows us to manage that herd. So like I mentioned earlier, you know, when we have those bull calves that we wanted to get out of the herd, we just call them up and we can take them there. And that way, you know, it gives us a manageable size herd because, you know, we only have room for so many on the landscape there at Darby. So we need that partnership in order to kind of help us when we need to manage that herd. And it helps us just control those dynamics.
Do you know how many bison the wilds has?
You would have to fact check me on this for sure, but I want to say around, I think it's 150.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that is more.
I'm not, yeah, yeah. Again, I could be wrong. It could be 300. I can't remember exactly.
That's okay. But. Yeah. So is the idea to get the bison level, like, are you trying to grow the bison level? Like, what's the big picture plan here? Where will the bison go? If you can only have, you know, 10 to 13 or however many you can have versus how many the wilds can have realistically.
Yeah. So I think our main focus with the bison herd out there at Battelle Darby Creek is again, it's to create that conversation with the public about conservation and the importance of it. And I think that's really our main focus, is to get that interest. Because if people don't know, it's hard to care. And so the more we can kind of educate people on the importance of, you know, all the different things the bison represent, land management, conservation, all those things, that's really where the bison come in key to us. Now, that being said, you know, what the wilds is trying to do is probably more of what you're talking about as far as, you know, trying to get more bison throughout the U.S. And, you know, part of the thing that we run into too with our herd is, you know, we always want to make sure that we don't have like a bottleneck in the genetics because it is so small. So that's another thing we work with the wilds and we can kind of help them out, because if they want to get an animal out or control genetics in a smaller type of herd, we can kind of help with that too. So that's one of the things where we can kind of help them out.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And for Earth Day, we're talking about where the bison roam in Central Ohio with Jeff Hamilton, the park manager at Battelle Darby Creek. So how much space do your bison have? Like, how many acres do they need to be able to roam? I like saying roam, even though it's supposed to be buffalo. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. So we have about 60 acres split up into two different pastures. One is focused on like a summer type habitat as far as grasses that are really nutrient dense in the summer. And then the other pasture that we have them in is the winter pasture, and that has grasses that have more nutrients in the wintertime. So the nice thing, though, is, you know, we use those two and move them back and forth, and it's kind of reminiscent of how bison would migrate in those vast, you know, landscapes like were here before all the development.
So. Yeah, and you have the bison out all the time. It doesn't matter. It can be the dead of winter. People have an opportunity to see bison.
Yeah, they're always out there. That's kind of one of the questions that we get a lot that always makes us chuckle when people call and ask us, hey, are the bison out? And we're like, yep, yep, they're
they don't go anywhere.
They're kind
right?
of always out yeah. there. Yeah, okay. exactly.
It's not like you have a barn you put them in, like cows
yeah.
or something.
Yep, there's no shelf big enough to set all the bison on. So, yeah, they're always out.
Now, you have a recent new addition to the herd, which I guess is a new addition by accident. Can you tell me about the deer?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's not uncommon for us to see white-tailed deer kind of bounce in and out of the pasture area where the bison are. And there's a fence around it, but, you know, the deer can jump so high that they don't pay much attention to fences. But we've had one that found its way into the bison herd and just kind of decided that it liked it there. Mm-hmm. And so he's been hanging out with the bison. Actually, I think it's a she. But that deer's been hanging out with the bison for probably over a month now. And it's really weird. You know, deer are normally super active, kind of dusk and dawn. That's kind of their feeding time. And this deer is like adopted the kind of the pattern of the bison to where it just kind of hangs out there and eats all day long. And so it's really neat to see him. And the bison have just kind of accepted him. I mean, he just kind of beds, that deer will bed down and take a nap right in amongst the rest of the bison. So yeah, it's pretty funny. We're kind of enjoying seeing him out there. How long he's going to stay out there, I don't know. It's totally up to the deer. So,
I mean, I think it's smart on the deer's part. I mean, having all that extra protection with the bison, and if they're friends, do you see?
Absolutely. Yeah, I will say. So we do bring a veterinarian in from OSU to do vet checks on all the bison that we have twice a year. And we recently did one, and we were kind of wondering if the deer was kind of run through and visit the doctor with the rest of the bison, but. I think he saw the vet and decided that he had better or she had better things to do. So it did not come in for the annual checkup.
So the deer drew the line at the doctor.
That's
but
right.
it'll hang out otherwise.
That's right.
Now, I don't know if the deer has a name, but it hasn't been around long enough to attract a name.
Yeah. Not yet, but I'm sure it's coming.
Yes,
I'm sure it's
but
coming.
Do you name all of the bison?
I wouldn't say we name all of the bison. Some of them over the years, kind of the infamous ones, do kind of earn a nickname. Mm. But yeah, not every single one of them. So.
Okay. The infamous ones, is that like the troublemakers? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's the troublemakers. So... And sometimes it's not necessarily their name. It's their number that lives on in history. But we have one, 32, and she is definitely the troublemaker. Anytime we try to round them up or get them all together or get them to move, she's usually the one that's kind of talking everybody out of it. So she's the instigator, so to speak. So.
Watch out for number 32.
That's right. 32, if you're listening, we got our eyes on you.
If I go to Battelle Darby Creek today to look at the bison, will I see the deer too? Is it noticeable?
Yeah.
It,
well, he was there this morning on my way in. So yeah. Whether he's still there or not now, I can't say for sure, but...
You can't control a deer, right?
That's right.
Let alone you can't control the bison. You can barely control the bison, right? You can't control the deer. How big is a bison? Like, how much do they weigh? I'm not really good at putting context with that.
Sure. So a bull bison, you know, the males can get up to around 2,000 pounds, mm-hmm. and then the females about 1,000. So, for example, the bull that we have right now, he's probably put on some weight since the last time we weighed him, but I would guess he's probably around 1,400 pounds right now. And he's young. He's only a couple years old, so he's probably got some more growing to do. And then the calves, when they're born, are between like 30 and 70 pounds, so... Mm-hmm.
Is the goal, I mean, do they all have one calf a year? Is there a goal with that? With the breeding, I guess, is there a goal?
I mean, part of the, I think, again, it's just, everybody loves to see babies, you know, it's exciting, you know, the bison calves are called red dogs because they have this really cool red color and people are always excited to see that. And plus, it's just cool to see that whole part of the dynamic of the herd. I know one year when we had calves, out of nowhere, the bull was almost like celebrating. He was just, I don't know how else to describe it. He was just doing this dance around the pasture right after the calf was born. And so it's just little things like that.
I'm a dad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're seeing the whole, you know, you're seeing the whole thing. And that's kind of one of the nice things about having calves.
Are there any next steps you want to tell me about? Are you just going to keep maintaining the same number of bison? Is there any plan for growth, or do you think you've hit your max in that 10 to 15 range?
Yeah, I mean, we are kind of limited as far as pasture size. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're always thinking about other things that we can do. Is there a place to expand that makes sense? So I wouldn't say that that's off the table. But right now, you know, we're really happy with the program. We're really happy with the way, you know, the public's how they view it and the conversations that we have with them about it. and everything seems to be working really well. So like I said, we're not opposed to that. If something makes sense to do it, then we would consider it, but I don't have any plans right now to expand it.
All right. That was Jeff Hamilton, Park Manager, Battelle Darby Creek. Thank you for your time today.
No, thanks. Happy to be here.
And coming up, we're going to talk about clean energy. Solar and wind had a banner year in 2024. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. 2024 was an impressive year for clean energy in the U.S. Solar and battery storage saw major improvements, and EV sales continue to rise. Clean energy continues to contribute to electricity production in the U.S. And with today being Earth Day, we will look at clean energy production and where it stands. Joining us to discuss the changes in clean energy is Lori Byrd, the Director of U.S. Energy at the World Resource Institute. Welcome to All Sides, Lori.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Can you start by telling me about what the growth of both solar and battery storage, the growth that we saw last year? We're just had a lot more solar in the past year or so.
Yeah, we set a record for installation of solar last year, and it brought it to about 7% of electricity nationwide, so supplying about 7% of the electricity now. With wind, it's about 17%, and that's actually more than was supplied from coal last year. Battery storage, which is often coupled with solar or wind, nearly doubled last year as well. So we've seen very significant growth. And they were the largest contributors to new power plants that came online. The renewables and batteries supplied about 90% of that of the new generation that came online. So, you know, exceeding other types of generation that are coming online.
Now, how did that improvement in 2024 compare to past years? Is that a lot of growth compared to, you know, like, I don't know, 5-10 years ago?
Yeah, well, we have seen, you know, over the 10-year period, we've seen the costs of solar and batteries dropping substantially. So we've seen a steady uptick and the deployment of them. But for the last maybe 5 years or something like that, renewables have been the dominant sources of new power generation that have been added to the system. So we have been seeing this for some time.
And talking about solar for a minute, what challenges come up with increasing the amount of solar production we have in the U.S.? Is it just building and finding the places for the solar farms that we see throughout the landscape? Or what other challenges are we seeing with solar production?
Well, some issues that we've been seeing are actually grid access. We need to expand our transmission grid, and there are a lot of solar projects that are ready to go, but they cannot connect to the grid. So we need to, there's some reforms that have been instituted that are underway to make it faster to interconnect to the grid, but they haven't fully taken effect yet. So that's one big barrier, is that we have things, projects that are ready to go, but they just can't connect. And we need more transmission capacity to be able to get everything on the grid. We're also expecting a lot of load growth in the coming years because of new AI data centers and some manufacturing facilities and so forth. So there's a lot of pressure on the grid because we're expecting just a lot of new facilities that need to be supplied with electricity.
Yeah, the idea of data centers is a big deal here in Ohio. I mean, we're building a lot of them, and we're realizing as we're building them that they take up a lot of power. Is solar a way to help with that? If all of these new projects, I mean, I'm sure if you had your way, they would all have solar panels on the roofs, right?
Yeah, solar is one of the things that's used for the data center, solar with storage. You know, some of the facilities are looking at other types of generation sources that can operate around the clock. So we have seen a couple of large tech companies make enter into contracts with nuclear facilities to reopen to supply upcoming data centers. So that's a trend we've also been seeing.
Now, when you said they're having trouble connecting to the grid, I'm trying to like understand that without understanding, you know, energy generation completely. So if you have solar panels on your house, you know, it connects to the power in your house. But if you have a solar farm, it collects all this energy and it has to go somewhere. Is that what you mean when you say connect to the grid?
Yeah. It has to go through the transmission system. That's, you know, high voltage. And then it goes to the distribution system that feeds everyone's houses in the neighborhood and so forth. So,
yeah. And I mentioned earlier the idea of battery storage. And you talked about how battery storage tends to go hand in hand when you're talking about solar and wind. For someone who's unfamiliar with battery storage, I mean, it's a very important factor in clean energy. Can you tell us more about battery storage?
Yeah, one of the things that it does with solar is that it just enables it to operate over longer periods of the day. So a lot of time, you know, solar starts to go off in the evening, right, when the sun is going down. But people come home from work and they're cooking and there's a lot of electricity demand, you know, later in the day. So it's a peak period. So what the batteries enable it to do is to store some of the solar when you don't need it in the middle of the day, or if there's more, or you know, shift it from parts of the day when you don't need it to parts of the day when you do.
Okay, and so the technology for battery storage has improved in recent years.
Yeah, the costs have come down very substantially.
Okay, are they getting? We have a Tech Tuesday segment we do regularly, and we've talked about the batteries even getting smaller too of what they can do. Have you seen that?
You know, the size and density is more of an issue for the electric vehicle applications rather than when you're doing a power plant and so forth. But yes, that's true. I mean, there's been a lot of improvement to increase the density and the power output of the batteries and so forth.
So the big battery storage, whenever you're talking about in a power plant, that has improved as well. Are we able to just do more with
Yeah, it's lithium ion batteries, but yes, there's been substantial improvements over time in that as well. Similar technologies.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And for Earth Day, we're talking about clean energy with Lori Bird, the director of U.S. Energy at the World Resource Institute. Now, the Trump administration's energy policy, or at least part of it, is called Unleashing American Energy. It focuses on rare earth minerals. It eliminates the electric vehicle mandate and touts consumer choice. It also discusses domestic energy resources, which includes a focus on oil, coal, and natural gas. So where do you see solar power going in the next few years under the Trump administration?
Well, solar actually has a lot of momentum, and it is a domestic energy resource. We actually have enough solar module manufacturing in the U.S. now to supply all the solar that we need. So, and with that's been, we've been increasing that, and we're increasing the amount of solar cell production as well. We're not, solar does not rely on fuel, so we don't have to worry about getting fuel from elsewhere, right? You're siting it domestically within the country, and the tax revenues go to the local communities from the solar projects and things like that. Landowners get benefits as well. So it is a domestic energy resource. So, and if you look at even the Department of Energy made projections earlier this year in January and indicated that solar would continue to be the dominant source of new generation that was installed. The other real benefit of solar is that it can be installed pretty quickly compared to other forms of power plants, like a natural gas plant or something like that. It takes many years to build a new one.
So it doesn't take as long to install a solar panel farm?
Correct.
I read in the Wall Street Journal recently that the growing belief is that the Trump administration will slow down clean energy but won't stop it. Do you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I think that's it. There's definitely intent to try to slow it down. I think, you know, offshore wind, some of the provisions and actions by the Trump administration, you know, are very targeted in trying to slow that down or remove leases. And there are some impacts being seen there, I think. There's also some of the executive orders make it more difficult to permit wind facilities as well. So We still need to see how those things play out, but that could be slowing some of the development of renewables.
Yeah. And well, another clean energy that's often mentioned when we've talked about solar for the past few minutes, but is wind. You mentioned wind just then. You mentioned it at the beginning. Wind has seen a similar growth to solar, but then it started to stagnate. What is happening with the use of wind to generate energy?
Yeah, so we have seen, wind does supply a lot of electricity in the US. It's about 10%, but we've seen, less installed in recent years, in part because of the same grid-related challenges of connecting it to the grid. There's also been a lot of offshore wind projects that have been planned and are in the implementation processes, and there have been some projects that have moved forward. But now there's some level of stagnation there, or concerns about leases being removed or plants being targeted by the administration to not move forward. Also, we have seen price increases for as interest rates have risen. It's made those projects more expensive, and so that's been a challenge too for some of the offshore wind. But yeah, I mean. Earlier this year, as I said, the Department of Energy made projections about what types of facilities might go forward, and they did were showing that wind, we could be seeing some wind energy installations this year. So
Yeah,
it remains to be seen how some
and
of this plays out, right? It's very,
yeah.
it's rapidly changing environment in terms of how these executive orders will actually be implemented and what goes, goes through the courts and remains in place.
Yeah, well, when it comes to both solar and wind, that same Wall Street Journal article I mentioned before was talking about how the private market will keep it going as well, even if things at the federal level slow down, there is a lot of interest and money to be made when it comes to solar and wind. Do you agree?
Yeah, that's true. And actually, a big driver for it is also companies like large tech companies and others that have clean energy goals and climate goals and are still meeting those. So, this is companies like Amazon and Google and Meta and Microsoft and Walmart, Target, a lot of different companies are purchasing large amounts of clean energy and have been for many years. And as their electricity needs grow, they are committed to moving forward with doing that.
And have you seen increases in solar and wind in certain states over others? Are there certain states that are like leaning into this more heavily than others?
Yes. Well, there are 24 states that have policies in place to get their to have 100% clean energy supplied for their electricity. So, we see a lot of states making these commitments to move towards clean energy. So there's that piece. But maybe I'm not sure if your question is more of where is the generation being installed, because that also can matter. But because Texas, for example, is an area where we see a lot of installation of projects and a lot of growth.
Yeah, I was looking to see if there's any sort of state that we should look toward as a prime example because they're going cleaner more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot. This, as I mentioned, it's about half of the states that are moving towards clean energy, and many of them are moving pretty quickly to do so, and are committed. It's more than half of the population as well that are covered by these goals.
Yeah. And what do you think it means that last year when solar and wind are combined, they surpassed coal in energy production? Is that going to continue? Do you see that as a just the as the future?
Yes, coal has been. We're seeing a lot of retirements of coal plants or plans for retirement in the future, because it hasn't been as cost effective. There's a lot of emissions associated with the plants and so forth. And we have an aging coal fleet, and there are no coal plants actually planned, like additional new coal plants that are really planned at this stage, because of the economics, right? So there's more interest in new natural gas plants than there is coal. So there are planned retirements. There has been more discussion of trying to either delay some of those retirements or operate coal plants a little bit more to meet some of these growing electricity needs. So we might see in the short term a little bit of an uptick in use of coal for those reasons. And the Trump administration has also an executive order around that, trying to keep some of these plants online for reliability and things like that. So we'll have to see how that plays out as well. But it is it's an economic issue as well, that it's not the most cost-effective resource. So that's part of why we're seeing retirements.
Yeah. And in the last minute we have left, besides the environmental benefits, which we've talked about, of building more clean energy, what are other benefits that come from it? Is that, tell me about the economics.
Come from which?
Benefits that come from clean energy, besides environmental benefits. There's other benefits too. That's a part, it's the money as well.
Yeah, exactly. There are a variety of benefits in terms of local jobs, community tax revenues. I mentioned some of that. Domestic production, energy security, because we're not reliant on fuels that we're at the global markets and things like that. So our energy independence basically is improved by using renewable resources that are here in the U.S.
Well, that was Lori Bird, Director of U.S. Energy at the World Resource Institute. Thank you so much for your time today, Lori.
Thank you. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day. And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Durovich, and happy Earth Day.